From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a water main break means boil water orders for 12 Oakland County communities.
Unfortunately, a water main break isn't an unusual occurrence. Something of this size and this magnitude is unusual.
We practice these types of situations. We have an emergency preparedness team.
Plus, Michigan's safe delivery for newborns law, a safety net for a mom who can't care for her newborn.
This young woman is brave and courageous and knows that she wants to give her baby a future that she can't provide, and this is a way to do it.
And theater talk from a phantom to battling suburban parents, and Hamlet thrown in for good measure.
This selection that we have that, you know, playing and opening this week, it's an amazing breadth of material for theater goers to see.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. More water trouble to report here in the Great Lakes State. A dozen communities in Oakland County are under a boil water advisory after a water main broke late Monday afternoon on 14 Mile Road between Farmington and Drake Roads. Yet another reminder that Michigan is saddled with aging water and sewer infrastructure. Earlier this month, civil engineer Ronald Brenke spoke on Stateside about these problems.
Some of these facilities are over 100 years old, and they're clearly not functioning right. You know, the sinkhole in Fraser. We don't want to see that, but we will see more of that if we don't start to recognize the issues that we have and start trying to find new solutions and more revenue to pay to repair some of these facilities. It's kind of out of sight, out of mind, but it is something that affects the public health and safety of everyone in Michigan.
Well, it's certainly not out of sight, out of mind for people living in Bloomfield Township, Commerce, parts of Farmington Hills, Kego Harbor, parts of Novi, Novi Township, Oakland Township, parts of Rochester Hills, Walled Lake, West Bloomfield Township, and Wixom. So quite a list here. And Tracy Samilton of Michigan Radio's news team has been out checking things out. Where did you go today, Tracy?
Well, first stop was Providence Park Hospital, where they had to move four dialysis patients, and they're turning away the ambulances there for emergency care to go to other hospitals.
And that's in Novi.
That's correct. In fact, most of the places I went to were in Novi. Most of the restaurants shut down. Like, if you're hungry and you can't cook at home because you don't have water, well, good luck. You're going to have to go somewhere where that is not affected by this water main break. But I did stop at a China King that was open, and they were boiling the water in these massive woks.
Okay.
In order to be able to serve their customers. Stopped at a Kroger, and people were going in, seeing the sign, "We have no water," and leaving. I talked to a woman who said when she turns on her tap in Novi, nothing comes out. Like, there's nothing at all. So she doesn't even have any water to flush her toilet. Now, the impressive thing in Novi that's going on is they're distributing water already. Four bottles per person per day throughout the city of Novi. If you need non-potable water to flush your toilet, they have distribution sites there as well.
So they jumped on it pretty quickly.
They
now,
did.
This all happened late yesterday afternoon. This broken water main at 14 Mile Road between Farmington and Drake Roads late yesterday afternoon, and certainly it's affected these dozen communities. You were at the site of the break?
I was at the site. I had to creep through some brambles through somebody's private property to get close to see what's going on, but it's a big mess. Half of the road is just covered in, you know, this green water. They've got these emergency, you know, pipe setups to get the water out. They're digging up the road so that they can actually get in there and replace the pipe. And when they say it might be, you know, late Friday before people get water again, I believe it based on the size of what's going on there.
Giving us the report from the water main break and some of the businesses in Novi with Tracy Samilton, Michigan Radio News. Thanks, Tracy.
Sure thing.
And now we turn to Margaret Klobuchar. She's chief operating officer of Providence Park Hospital in Novi. And she's had a pretty long night and day dealing with the water problems there. Margaret, how are you doing at Providence Park? What's the status right now?
So the status is that we have lost our water at about 4:30 this morning. We are able to care for our patients. Those who are coming in via car to the emergency room, we can absolutely care for. We have had to close to ambulance traffic, though, and elective surgeries, just to be on the safe side.
How are you able to care for inpatients or for people in the emergency rooms when you don't have water?
We have plenty of bottled water. We practice these types of situations. We have an emergency preparedness team, and we do drills just like this. So when we have real live situations, such as last night, we are able to go right into our command center and put ourselves into full operation mode using bottled water, jugs of water, and we also have wells in the hospital underneath that we were able to pull some water from.
Did you have the water on hand, or is that part of your plan where you've got a certain amount but then you can pull in more as needed?
Yes, we have a certain amount that we have in-house at all times. And then we certainly worked with our distributors very quickly last evening when we knew this could be a potential problem to get even more in.
Margaret, I'm interested about the wells. Would that be, for example, you would use that water for emergency and trauma surgeries?
No, we only use that to be able to have bathroom facilities and things like that. We don't use it for patient care.
The word is the earliest that the boil water advisory might be lifted is Friday. How do you envision things going between now and then?
You know, I anticipate that we will continue as much normal operation as we can and as we have, and I don't foresee any issues at this point.
What about outpatient appointments and procedures?
We are trying to do as many outpatients as we can as far as our imaging services, so our x-rays. We are not doing outpatient procedures at this point. Again, just to, in case we have to do emergencies, we want to make sure that we have all the equipment we need for that.
Did you have to move any patients to Providence Hospital in Southfield?
So we have moved about 4 patients at this point. They are dialysis patients. To do dialysis, you require a hookup to water source, and obviously we are unable to provide that at this point in time. So we have transferred 4 patients to Southfield.
So bottom line, what do you want patients and family members to understand about where Providence Park Hospital is right now with this water problem?
We want you to know that everybody here or anybody that comes to us is safe and in good hands, and we will continue to provide the best care possible.
Margaret Klobuchar is Chief Operating Officer of Providence Park Hospital in Novi, along with Henry Ford Hospital in West Bloomfield, one of the hospitals affected by the water main break and boil water advisory in Oakland County. Margaret, a long night for you and a long day ahead, but thank you so much for taking time to talk with us.
No problem. Thank you.
Mark Hansel is Special Programs Chief with the Oakland County Health Division. Mark, what have you been doing and with whom are you involved?
Yes, well, it's been a long day. The Oakland County Health Division and the Great Lakes Water Authority and our Water Resources Commissioner's Office opened up the Emergency Operations Center last night, and they have been working through the night to coordinate the messaging and make sure that people stay safe during this water main break.
Yeah, I'm wondering how communication is going, because as you pointed out, there's a lot of movable parts here.
It is. It does update and change quite frequently. So we definitely want to tell people in those affected cities, villages, or townships to touch base with those websites and the social media efforts from those cities for the latest, greatest updates in their area.
Now, we're not just talking homes here. We're talking businesses, adult and child daycare centers and restaurants. So what are you
Absolutely.
Telling them?
Our big focus here at the health division is to ensure that the restaurants and daycares and adult care facilities, long-term care facilities, are aware of what the issue is, how they can respond to the issue at their individual business. And depending on the situation in their area, it may be different. So they definitely want to stay up to date. But right now, it is primarily a boil water notice. People and businesses may be experiencing low water pressure. They may have no water at all, or they may be experiencing some discoloration in their water even. But a boil water notice is an indication that they need to boil water for at least 1 minute and let it cool before they use it. Restaurants have an emergency action plan that they can implement in boil water situations where they can implement certain practices and procedures to help keep their patrons safe as well.
And they're up to date on that. I'm just wondering, health-wise, Mark, what do people risk by not following that boil water order? If they're like, well, you know, there's water coming out of the tap, it looks fine. What are they risking?
Yeah, the reason for the boil water is anytime that we have a rupture in the piping system that transports our drinking water, it can allow the introduction of certain contaminants. And primarily we're worried about microbes, you know, bacteria and things that are naturally present in the soil that just being exposed to the air that can get into the transportation system of our drinking water. So if those contaminants can enter into the water, we do use the boiling to help reduce the possibility of getting sick from those contaminants.
Sick in what ways?
Well, some symptoms related to, you know, a waterborne illness mimic a lot of other illnesses, you know, even the common cold or foodborne illness, where it can be nausea, vomiting. You can have some cramps. It can be with or without fever. And if you're experiencing any of those symptoms, certainly you would want to contact your healthcare provider.
Now, do people need to flush their lines or drain the hot water heater?
Yes and no. Once the repair has been made to this large water main, there can be some sediment and things that break loose from the piping system while the repairs are being made, and you could potentially experience some discolored water and things like that. So flushing, once the all clear, is a very, very good idea.
Mark, do you, you know, not you personally, but does the Oakland County Health Division practice for this kind of situation, really drill down to be ready in this event of something of this magnitude?
Unfortunately, a water main break isn't an unusual occurrence. Something of this size and this magnitude is unusual. But the principles and the practices related to a boil water notice really remain the same, whether it was a single community that was affected or 12 to 13 communities that are affected in this case. So we practice, certainly, but in real life situations, yes.
So again, we're hearing it may take until Friday. And what are the main websites people should be going to for the best and latest information?
Websites of interest to folks that have questions regarding the boil water notice would certainly include the Oakland County Health Division website, and that is at www.oakgov.com/health. There is also a very good question and answer portion of the Great Lakes Water Authority website, and that is glwater.org. For up-to-date information in your specific area, if you are in one of the affected areas, those cities, villages, and townships are doing a very good job keeping their websites updated and pushing a lot of information through social media.
Mark Hansel, Special Programs Chief with the Oakland County Health Division. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Mark.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
The Michigan Safe Delivery for Newborns law was passed in 2001, giving mothers who can't care for their newborn a way out that protects the babies, and it's working.
The majority of infants, 196, have actually been surrendered at hospitals, primarily born at hospitals, and surrendered after delivery.
That comes next here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A news report of a newborn left in a dumpster or trash can brings a feeling of sadness, bewilderment. You ask yourself, why and how could a mother leave her helpless newborn to fate and the elements? Before 2001 in Michigan, desperate parents didn't have many options if they couldn't care for that newborn, abandoning a child, a 10-year felony. But in 2001, Michigan's Safe Delivery for Newborns law was passed. It allows parents to surrender their newborns inside a safe place, no questions asked. It's anonymous, safe, and legal. Over 200 babies have been delivered to safety through this program. Paula Springer has seen firsthand how the Safe Delivery program is saving babies. She's director of the Eastern Michigan Office of Adoption Associates. Paula, welcome.
Thank you, Cindy. I'm very happy to be here.
Your agency has had a lot of experience in placing these infants surrendered under safe delivery, and the whole key is they do get a chance at life.
Yes. It's wonderful. It's a great option for young women who want to provide a good future for their baby, but due to many reasons are afraid to come forward and go through a regular adoption process.
Take us back a few years now. What was the typical scenario that would lead to these so-called trash babies before 2001?
Well, it was a young woman who usually concealed her pregnancy, and not necessarily a particular age. It could be a woman of any age. The idea was that she didn't tell anyone about her pregnancy. If she was a teen, maybe she was afraid to tell her parents or teachers. If she was a little bit older, she was afraid to tell other people in her life, maybe afraid or intimidated by the birth father, maybe afraid of violent circumstances. And so she would conceal the pregnancy and abandon the baby in an unsafe way.
And dumpsters and trash cans are one. We've heard of students drowning a baby in a toilet, which is just, I mean, it just rips your heart out when you hear this. So what did this law make possible?
This law is Michigan's response to this problem. Every state now in the nation has what's called a safe haven law. Mm-hmm. And Michigan's safe delivery of newborns law is meant to give women an option to anonymously and confidentially surrender their baby in a safe atmosphere and know that that baby will have a permanent home and future with an approved adoptive family.
What kind of places are babies being surrendered?
Very specifically identified in the law are hospitals, fire stations, police stations, or a 911 responder. The majority of infants, 196, have actually been surrendered at hospitals, primarily born at hospitals, and surrendered after delivery, which is a little different than the creators of the law imagined. But delivering a baby at home or in private circumstances is probably a pretty terrifying thing. Mm-hmm. So young women do go to a safe place to have their baby, which is good for them and good for the baby, and then surrender the baby through the Michigan Safe Delivery Law.
Before that, if a young woman had been in the hospital and left the baby behind, mm-hmm. she would have faced charges?
Well, if she left the baby behind, mm-hmm. the hospital would call protective services.
So suddenly there's this world of legal stuff.
And she would not be charged criminally, mm-hmm. but it would be through neglect and abandonment. Whereas if she abandoned the baby in a dumpster or any right. of the other things you're talking about, that is that criminal charge. Mm-hmm. Now she faces neither criminal charges nor abandonment or neglect charges.
And then how do agencies like yours, like Adoption Associates, work in interface with this law?
So the first step in the safe delivery law is that she surrenders the baby to an emergency service provider. That emergency service provider makes sure the baby's safe. Not at a hospital, they have to transport to a hospital. And then the hospital social worker will contact an agency like Adoption Associates to make a plan for the baby. And we are required to make an immediate placement of the baby with a pre-approved adoptive family. So the baby does not go into the foster care system, does not kind of languish in a future
in limbo.
Secured.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But the baby is placed with a permanent adoptive family who will get involved with a baby in the hospital if the baby remains there, or take the baby home immediately from the hospital upon discharge. And then there's another series of legal steps we need to go through. But that baby gets immediately involved and identified for an adoptive family.
So you don't have somebody shunt it off into foster care.
Exactly.
Where that's a whole other set of circumstances. Mm-hmm. So you've got families who are ready, saying they're pre-approved, and they're saying our homes and our hearts are open.
Exactly.
Do we have a kind of a profile or common traits of these moms who are surrendering their babies? I mean, kind of take us into the thought process.
Not necessarily a descriptive profile in terms of age, but it does have to do with a young woman who, for whatever reasons, cannot care for another baby. She may have other children who she's caring for and knows she can't take on another responsibility. She may not have a supportive community surrounding her to provide her with help for the baby. She may not have gotten prenatal care because her baby has been kept a secret. And she wants to know that this baby is well cared for. She still really cares about the future of the baby. This young woman is brave and courageous and knows that she wants to give her baby a future that she can't provide. And this is a way to do it.
Mm. Now, are we still seeing babies who are being left to the elements, left in trash cans, left in dumpsters?
Yes, sadly. Not as many, hopefully. Mm-hmm. But that's why programs like this, who can provide this information to the general community, are so important. And people involved in safe delivery law are very, very involved in trying to make sure that that information gets out by providing people for interviews, information, educators at hospitals. Adoptive agencies do the same thing, educating people that this is an option so people don't have to abandon their baby to a dangerous situation.
There was a burst of coverage in 2001, but if that wasn't on your radar, and you, as you say, we're talking 17 years later, so some of these young moms might not even been alive when these
exactly.
stories were going on. Has the law been modified or changed at all since it was first passed?
Yes, there have been some minor revisions. One was to recently add the ability for one of those emergency service providers mm-hmm. to be a 911 responder who's coming to respond to a call to pick up a baby. Initially, it was only hospital, fire station, and police station. No babies have been surrendered to a 911 caller yet, but there does happen to be some new conversation going on about changes that might be beneficial to the law. I do participate with a subcommittee looking at the law in Lansing and making recommendations for changes. And one of them, you know, is looking at better ways to get information out. What are ways should we expand the definition to emergency facilities, not just hospitals? I mean, there are a lot of different possible changes in the law that may come in the future, but legislative change takes a long time.
Is there bipartisan support for this
there
law?
There seems to be.
There
yes,
does.
Absolutely.
So you're encouraged with the yes. reception in Lansing.
Yes.
Where would someone go to get information, to get it into the hands of the mothers who may be at risk of abandoning a baby?
Really, the best place to get information, including forms, information, even some training segments, is on the Safe Delivery website. So it would be Michigan Safe Delivery of Newborns website, and you can just find that by Googling, very easy. And there's lots of information there for both training, for emergency service providers, for schools, for adoption agencies. There are handbooks developed. You can call and ask for, or even just request online, ask for materials, forms, posters, brochures. The state is more than willing to get this information out and will do anything to help cooperate that and spread the word.
Paula Springer directs the Eastern Michigan Office of Adoption Associates. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Time for another edition of Theater Talk. David Kiley of Encore Michigan is with us now with the latest look at productions from professional theater companies all around the state. And David, we're starting with a show with a big name pedigree that's making its North American premiere tomorrow night at the Fisher Theater in Detroit.
Yes, this is Love Never Dies, and it's a reboot of the show by Andrew Lloyd Webber, which is a sequel to his Phantom of the Opera, which, of course, is an enormous fan favorite on Broadway and in touring shows and still going in the West End of London. But this show, which features the scarred and half-masked Phantom, began its journey in London in 2010, and it did not receive good notices.
Yeah, didn't go down well, did it?
Much to Weber's chagrin. And the joke about the show, which ran around social media and the internet, was it should be called Love Should Die, or Paint Never Dries. I love that.
So he has retooled that, and that's what's opening at the Fisher. What's the plot? Where do we find the Phantom and Christine Daae?
So the show is set in Coney Island, New York, in Brooklyn, not far from Broadway, which is where Weber hopes to take the show.
A great change from the Paris Opera House, I'm just saying.
And the Phantom has landed on the shores of the U.S. after the fire engulfed the Paris Opera House, which is the climax of the original. And the Phantom has been a recluse for a decade, waiting to reunite with his Christine. Mm. And he writes a composition, and he fakes an invitation to her from Oscar Hammerstein, not the Oscar Hammerstein of Rodgers and Hammerstein, but actually the first Oscar Hammerstein, who wrote around the turn of the 20th century. And gets Christine to come to America to perform it at a theater he has started.
Okay. And she's got a son, right, as I understand?
I believe so, yeah. I'm actually going to see it tomorrow night. It has been running in previews for a few nights now.
I know, in fact, Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber was in Detroit for that the other
night. He was. Yes. He's been on stage a few times to take some bows and pictures and, you know, this kind of thing.
All right, let's listen to some excerpts from some of the songs in Love Never Dies by Andrew Lloyd Webber. Phantom was such a monster hit when it opened in London in 86 and Broadway in 88. Does this huge, bombastic, and fantastic musical, do you think, like that, does that still move the needle for audiences in 2017?
It does, because there are so many patrons who really only see maybe a couple of shows a year. And whether you're in New York or whether you're going to go to the Fisher where you've got a subscription or the West End, the tourist trade, they want to see a big show, you know. So that's why, that's one of the reasons Phantom has lasted this long. I mean, not only is it, you know, a very wonderful production, but it has that big vastness. Mm-hmm. And also, the Phantom of the Opera is a story that has been translated in virtually every language. So wherever you're coming from around the world, you know the story.
Yes, you do. You do indeed. Well, from the Fisher Theater to Detroit's Midtown, to a more intimate venue, we should say, the Open Book Theater in Trenton in Wayne County.
Right. Much smaller venue than the Fisher. Much smaller show. This show, which is opening this weekend, is called Be a Good Little Widow.
Interesting title.
And it's a play about the difficulty of grieving correctly. And I really like this theme. I haven't seen it. I'll be seeing it this weekend. But the central character is a widow, and she's struggling to figure it out after her husband dies. And she's getting way more input in kibitzing from her late husband's mother than anybody would ever want. And it's billed as kind of a sad comedy, okay, right? Which, given the subject, is not too surprising, right? Anyone who's experienced a death of a close one, a spouse, even a parent, knows that eventually, sad as it is, there's a slow build of moments that can, in fact, make you laugh. That's part of the grieving and getting over it.
Interesting. The title, Be a Good Little Widow, just says so much. That sounds real, real interesting. Now we head to Chelsea, to the Purple Rose Theater.
Yeah, this is a special play. I just want to say that up front. It's called God of Carnage, and a lot of people are familiar with it, but a lot of people won't be. It's a mighty heavy-sounding title. And what it's about, though, is two couples who have come together to settle, debate, argue, discuss an altercation in the school playground between their two sons, in which one kind of whacked the other one in the face with a stick and caused a little dental, you know, damage and everything. And you know that when two modern-day sets of parents start discussing an episode like this, the situation is fraught. It's tense. It's awkward. So I got a chance to talk to the director, Lauren Knox, and she says, sure, the play is about the surface story, but it's also very much more than that.
The play is about being polite until we can't be polite anymore. So it's about trying to put your best foot forward, trying to put on, as they say, liberal niceties, only to realize they actually think that they know how to do everything the best way.
That veneer gets stripped thin. Now, I remember Jeff Daniels, the late James Gandolfini, Marcia Gay Harden, and Hope Davis did this on Broadway in 2009, and then I know they reunited in L.A. in 2011. And then there's that 2011 film version, Carnage, and that had Christoph Waltz, Jodie Foster, Kate Winslet, and John C. Reilly. I'd love to have seen the Daniels Gandolfini one, but I did see the film, and I know that the playwright was involved in writing that screenplay.
Yeah, and Jeff has played both the male characters.
He said they'd flip off.
Right.
They'd flip back and forth. Yeah.
In different productions. He was the one who chose to make sure that the Purple Rose did this show. And Lauren Knox got the benefit of having Jeff come in during Tech Week, I think, and give notes and, you know, and tweak. I want to say something very interesting about this show. When you read the script, it says basically it'll take 80 minutes. And that's what the productions that we've seen have been, about an 80-minute thing. This was over in 60. And I thought, what just happened? They cut nothing from the script.
Okay.
But the pacing really got picked up, and it makes it a really it's not a minute too short, it's not a minute too long. It is a brilliant production, and I urge everybody to see it. Purple Rose's runs are nice and long, but don't wait. It's a wonderful production.
Now we head from Chelsea to Alpena and the Thunder Bay Theater.
Right, our friends up in Alpena, you know, if you're up that way, leaf peeping on the east coast of Michigan, Shakespeare, which we usually see in the summer months, is alive and well there, with a production of Hamlet that opens this weekend. So perhaps some fans of the Bard want to go up to Alpena for a little Shakespeare.
And then we're ending at Theater Nova in Ann Arbor for something that's really ripped from today's headlines.
Yes, it's a play called Resisting. And this is a play about systemic racism that we find in the country's legal system. This is not escapism theater like Love Never Dies.
Yes.
But as you say, it's ripped really from the newspapers. It's based on a true story about a young black woman who begins to film an incident of police brutality and then is herself subjected to really shocking treatment by the police and becomes embroiled in a legal battle of her own. She's a white public defender, and the two have to decide how far they're willing to go to seek justice here. Justice has a price, both financial and otherwise. And I think that this selection that we have, that, you know, playing and opening this week, it's an amazing breadth of material for theatergoers to see.
It sure is. So we'll recap. Theater Nova in Ann Arbor presenting Resisting. The Thunder Bay Theater in Alpena is doing Hamlet. God of Carnage at the Purple Rose in Chelsea. Trenton's Open Book Theater with the sad comedy Be a Good Little Widow. And the Fisher Theater in Detroit with the North American premiere of Andrew Lloyd Webber's Love Never Dies, the rebooted sequel to Phantom of the Opera. As always, thanks to David Kiley of Encore Michigan, and just head to EncoreMichigan.com and you can get details on these and other professional theater productions around Michigan. Thanks, David.
Thanks so much, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Up next, what did the arts community and the public lose when local reviewers vanished? Plus, Morningside neighbors talk about what they want from the city of Detroit. That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Newspapers battle to stay alive through cost-cutting, layoffs, early retirements, and by mergers. Fewer bodies in those newsrooms. Fewer local newspapers. And that's especially evident in the near absence of local arts reviewers and critics in so many Michigan towns and cities. And after a decade or so of shrinking arts coverage, the arts community is feeling the loss.
The fact that there's no arts coverage in the paper has certainly impacted us negatively, I think, because, you know, the arts coverage and criticism in the Ann Arbor News was a central location that people knew to look for information about what was coming up, previews, reviews. They didn't have to go searching for it.
When we share the pieces, it's people that love and support the arts, which is great. But how do we reach that wider audience, that wider community? How are we getting the other people in our community and expanding that reach?
An important piece of any arts programming is the critical response that it generates. Those writers have an immense amount of institutional knowledge that goes along with every article that they write. And so when a community loses that, they're really losing somebody on the front lines of advocacy for the way that a community uses arts and cultural activity to grow and learn.
Those were voices from the Ann Arbor Civic Theater, Grand Rapids Civic Theater, and Art Prize. Here with us now is Ron Balmanis, who's a longtime local director, actor, and producer who runs an online review site, A2View.com. Ron, good to have you here.
Good to see you, Cynthia.
And from Grand Rapids, we welcome Holly Bushiri, who's the editor-in-chief of Cultured.gr. Hello, Holly.
Hi, Cynthia.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being, hey, it's all great, no problem, 10 being catastrophic, Ron, how do you rate the loss of local reviewers and critics to the arts community?
Personally, I think it's catastrophic. 8, 9, 10. Yeah, it's terrible. There was an instant change in audience numbers, publicity, the number of people who are aware of what's happening in the arts community. When the local newspaper laid off all their review staff, it was instantly a problem for theaters.
How about where you sit, Holly?
I agree with Ron. I would probably rate it a 7, though, because maybe it's just the slightly larger city in Grand Rapids, but there were other outlets still trying to get the news out. What we lost was that in-depth coverage, and that not only affected the number of seats that were being sold for an event, for example, but it also lowered people's ability to talk about the arts and their help grappling with how to understand the arts. So it's not just informational loss, but it's also this community connection loss in my mind.
What was the relationship like between the media and arts organizations back in the traditional model that we are talking about, where a paper had an arts critic? What was that relationship like?
Traditionally, what would happen was if you were doing a presentation, you would send out a press release or you would call the newspaper or the media outlet that was covering it. They would traditionally do a preview article, talk a little bit about the show and expose it a bit, and then they would come do a review and write a written response to what they saw. So not only were people getting exposure to the theater before you did the event, but then they were doing it afterwards and were able to then come see the show based on what they had read.
And Holly, how and when did things change?
In Grand Rapids, the last step, I mean, this has been a gradual diminishing problem for years. The last three remaining dedicated arts journalists here in Grand Rapids were lost at our local paper, Grand Rapids Press, in January of last year.
So here we are today. So many of these local papers have vanished or they've been subsumed by a single media entity, such as MLive.
Yes.
And you've both been working on websites that have tried to fill this gap in arts coverage in the mainstream, more general news media. Holly, briefly tell us how culture.gr works.
Culture.gr covers the visual and performing arts in the Grand Rapids community. So we're not trying to cover everything in West Michigan. We're focusing specifically on our community and working to connect our community to its creators. So we do everything from news and pre-coverage to conversations with creators. So those profile pieces that help the community get to know local artists. And then we also do reviews and art criticism.
And how are things going in terms of building an audience for Culture.gr?
That has been the easiest part of Culture.gr. It's clear that that loss of coverage has been felt not just by the cultural institutions, but by the community itself, because we have had a huge response to Culture.gr. Within the first quarter of existing, we had 250,000 social impressions, for example. I never have to explain what Culture.gr is when I meet new people. They all say, oh, yes, that's so great. You know, they all already know after 11 months.
How do you generate revenue?
Like any good nonprofit, we have a combination of revenue streams. So, of course, we always take individual donations, our individual donors. Sometimes it's just a straight donation. We also have a membership program where people can sign up for an automatic $5 or $10 donation a month and get a chance to join us on different unique events for our members. And then we have things like house parties where someone will host a party, invite their friends specifically to support Culture.gr. But then we also receive foundational support, a little bit of corporate support. We're working on improving that right now, and a really generous amount of organizational support as well.
Now, so I'm wondering how this lack of complete independence from arts organizations affects what's on your website.
You know, that's a question we get a lot, and it was interesting when we were proposing starting up Culture.gr, looking for that launch support to get going. When we talked to organizations, we were very clear to say, now this is not pay to play. Our original content is not determined by whether or not you support us. And they would ask questions like, well, could you write something bad about us? And we would say, well, yes, if there's something that needs improved, we're going to talk about it. And they were relieved. We even had organizations that would make sure that we knew about a similar organization in town that didn't have the same marketing budget, wouldn't be able to support us financially, but that we should pay attention to. So all of our sponsors go in understanding very clearly that it's not pay to play, that we can write negative reviews. At the institutional level, I think they understand that that's what's needed for a healthy arts ecosystem, is to have that independent voice, but they still wanted to support it because they understood that as a whole, our arts community is going to be healthier if we have that independent voice included.
Ron, how about A2View? Are you a one-man shop?
I am a one-man shop.
You
are. I'll occasionally bring in a guest reviewer, but it's primarily me.
And what do you cover exactly?
I cover musical theater in Southeast Michigan, sometimes as well as New York. I'll put reviews on from the musicals I see in New York.
Amateur and professional?
Amateur and professional. That was, in fact, where it started. As the coverage started to get lost in the media, in particular, amateur was no longer being covered. So I was like, well, someone needs to start covering this. So I started. And I started out with a pretty small followership. People know I'm brutally honest in my reviews. Started with a couple hundred. I'm up to about 8,000 hits per review at this point, which is tremendous. And clearly people need this. They want it. They want to see these reviews. I pay my own ticket. I go see what I want to see, and I review it.
How about revenue generating for
there,
the
There's no revenue generated by it.
You're doing this out of love.
I do it out of love. You know, I have a very strong theater background, years and years of directing and acting and doing professional theater and non-professional theater. And I just saw the lack. And, you know, I love musicals. I want people to know what's good and what to see and to help expose those because they're losing exposure everywhere else at this point.
There are other valiant efforts in addition to yours around the state. But let me ask you, are all of these a viable replacement, in your view, for what was lost when the bigger local news media scaled back their arts coverage? Holly, I'll let you start.
I think a lot of the attempts to replace it are, you know, limited by funding. And so when you only have the time you can give on a very limited budget, that's going to affect not only the number of stories that you can do, but how deep you can get into those stories and who you can hire to write them, what kind of expertise you can pull in to help your community connect to the arts. So we're facing the same problem that legacy media is, and that's the fact that journalism isn't pulling in as much financial support or financial revenue as it saw in the past. The internet really made this shift where we got everything for free and we stopped paying for it.
Do you think this is the permanent reality for arts organizations in Michigan?
I think it is at this point. The tremendous loss in the Southeast Michigan area is the lack of exposure. When you no longer have a print media, people don't know it exists. Now, it's fantastic for people that are already connected on social media and read blogs and use the internet. But then you're looking at this tremendous amount of art supporters in their 60s and over in particular who do not use the internet. They do not look up reviews. They do not see banner ads. They don't know these shows and things are even happening. I hear constantly, you know, I heard you did this great show last week. I hadn't heard of it. I'm thinking to myself, wow, I had it everywhere on social media. But they're right. They didn't see it in print media because those folks don't use internet. And that is, I think that is a permanent reality right now. How do you reach those folks? It's fantastic that I have, for example, 8,000 views, but they're basically the same viewers. It's people who are already exposed to this site.
They're already in the shop.
Yeah, they know this show is happening. They're looking it up to read what was that review? What did Ron say about it? The audience you're trying to reach is just not getting it.
I do have to ask, can you understand that if a newspaper is losing readership and fighting hard to keep revenue coming in, there have to be judgment calls, tough choices being made. So if you got to choose between covering a local theater group or art show and covering budget issues or environmental issues or people caught in the immigration crackdown, something has to give.
Absolutely. Now, the interesting thing is, if you go back historically, there have been critics, you know, for thousands of years for shows and theater and arts. And even as late as the 20s in New York, reviewers were interns that weren't paid, so that they weren't losing money on paying interns. Over the years, they became professional reviewers. In fact, there are colleges now that have theater criticism programs as part of their reviews, which probably are going to go by the wayside relatively soon. But in the meantime, we created this awesome group of people that are knowledgeable and know how to review.
I would say absolutely decisions need to be made. But I think the value that the arts bring to a community shouldn't be discredited when they're making those decisions. You know, there's research now that shows that participation in the arts is the second most influential in your perceived quality of life, your sense of well-being. It's second only to not having diseases. So that sense of well-being is not just on an individual basis, but also on a sense of community, a sense of connection to your community. Our community's health is affected by our connection to the arts. And so when we're making those decisions, yes, of course, we need to cover these big political and other news items, but we also need to make sure that we're keeping our communities healthy. And so when news organizations are making those decisions, I hope they can start to see how that, you know, affects our communities in a healthy system where we also need those connections to the arts.
Holly Bushiri is the editor-in-chief of Cultured GR. You can find her, the team's work, at cultured.gr. And Ron Bomanis, the one-man show behind A2View.com, and that is A2View. two is in the number two view.com, this online review site. Holly and Ron, thank you so much for your time and being with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Detroiters will soon vote for mayor, city council, and other offices. As part of the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, Michigan Radio's Lester Graham has been working in the Morningside neighborhood on Detroit's east side. He wanted to find out how well the priorities of the residents aligned with the candidates who are vying to be their city council member.
They aligned surprisingly well. I talked with a dozen residents of Morningside, and one of their top concerns was abandoned houses.
Right now, we have a lot of vacant houses. The grass doesn't get cut often.
Tear all these raggedy abandoned houses down to make it safer for myself and the children walking around here.
That was Sharon Lee and Michelle Drain, who worries a person might grab a woman or a kid off the street and drag them into a vacant house. Morningside is part of Detroit's District 4. The incumbent city council member is Andre Spivey. He says Detroit is putting all the money it can into tearing down vacant buildings.
Whatever funds we can give to you for demolition, we'll do just that. And it's a slow process, but we're getting there.
According to City of Detroit data, in just the last 3 years, 266 houses have been torn down in Morningside, nearly 2,000 in District 4, and nearly 13,000 total in the city, thanks to federal hardest hit funds. Spivey's challenger is Letitia Johnson. She knows empty houses attract people who will steal anything of value out of the house.
Scrappers are a huge problem. Of course, vacant houses are a huge problem.
She'd like to use those federal funds currently going to demolitions to help keep residents in their home.
I like to focus on being proactive and helping to reduce, eliminate the issue by utilizing the hardest hit fund dollars to help keep them there, so that more properties are not becoming blighted and we're not demolishing any more houses.
Which brings us to another issue of importance to Morningside residents, helping people get money for home repair.
They need to rebuild the houses, make it look a little more better.
Give them a helping hand to bring it up to code instead of using all that money to tear things down. There's no programs like that.
That was Ronisha Rayford and Kenneth Kennedy. One of the things you notice in many Detroit neighborhoods are houses with big blue tarps protecting the roof. Roof leaks can destroy a house fast, but a lot of folks can't afford to reshingle them. Spivey says there are some low-interest programs.
But you have to qualify for them. We do have CDBG grant dollars. Those go to organizations in the community, but then they can't serve the entire east side or all of Morningside.
So we'll continue to see those blue tarps for now. That is, unless whoever wins the election for mayor decides that those hardest hit funds might be better spent on fixing homes instead of seeing them added to the demolition list. Among the other issues, a few people mentioned crime and wanting more police patrols, but there was one thing mentioned several times I didn't really expect.
This neighborhood needs a recreation center.
An activity center? Youth and senior activity center.
There we heard from Mike Kemp and Corey Asbury. District 4 challenger Letitia Johnson also brought up the topic.
One thing that we do not have in District 4 is a rec center. Most districts throughout the city have two, more than likely three of them. Some have four.
She says residents on the east side of Detroit see a rec center as a priority. Councilman Andre Spivey says he'd like to see a public-private partnership to build and operate a rec center.
The mayor and I spoke, and the mayor said, we don't have any money at all. But I said, Mr. Mayor, if I find some private dollars, can we find some public dollars to match that? And so we are right now looking at some foundations and community associations to find some money. And we're not talking just a fly-by-night rec center, but a state-of-the-art rec center that can create its own revenue to sustain itself.
If that happens, Spivey thinks it should go to Chandler Park, where there's already a golf course and the Chandler Park Family Aquatic Center. Other things people want are illegal dumping stopped and loose dogs caught. But mostly, they just want people to realize that Morningside has a lot going for it, and people should buy a house there. For the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, I'm Lester Graham, Michigan Radio News.
Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.